we will have enough energy to take forward our mandate. I'm not going to say much, but I wish you all the best, all the people who are going to take up the task of ensuring that the electorate, because we are here, all of us, we have got one objective, is to ensure that the electorate receives the necessary service delivery that they deserve. And we must ensure that we take our responsibilities with very much accountability. With such few words, I wish to welcome you all. And this is a short day today. We must try our best. Even the honorable members, I request them that you must stick to the presentations when we are asking questions, because we still have a long way. We are going to engage each other now and again, timely. We are going to call the department every now and again to come before us. So this is not the end of the day if we are saying we are going to exhaust everything that we have today. We must try all our best. Honorable Deputy Minister, come next to Mr. Shaba. You are welcome, ladies. So I'm saying, I'm urging my colleagues to stick to the questions that are around the presentation. I think even next week we're going to engage all the time. I think this year we are going to take much more time in engaging each other, so that we take each other, because it means that we are going to take serious our mandate for this 5-year period. Thank you very much. Over to you, Mr. Lishabane. Can you take us through, or if you have got a few words, a couple of words, you are allowed to do so.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The management of the housing support entities is here. They will be addressing the committee to brief the committee in respect of their strategic plans. The Housing Development Agency will be the first to present, followed by the NHBRC. Mr. Adler is here, the acting CEO of NHBRC is here. I will invite the CEO, Mr. Adler, to address the committee in respect of the Housing Development Agency. The presentations are packaged and distributed to members in this pack. Then members would be able to follow on the screen. Mr. Adler.
Thank you. Before Mr. Adler, I'm sorry. Deputy Minister, because I think we are appreciating your presence here, because these debates or these engagements are very much important to us, to both us and the ministry. So if your presence to us means a lot. So just have a word of comfort to all of us.
Yes, I think we all starting afresh. So it's a breath of fresh air to hear what the entities are to present before us. Let's allow them to do so. And thanks for welcoming me. Thanks to the committee members. Thanks.
I'm not sure that qualified me for an initiation.
want to indicate to those who perpetuated the initiation this morning, I want to refer them to the headlines in the Star in the course of this week, where the schoolboys who perpetuated the initiation rite have landed up in hot water. But this morning, on our way to this gathering, we were informed that the gathering was in the old Treasury building in Pretoria. And you will imagine the line of cars behind me as I hit the brakes. But luckily, that fraud wasn't perpetuated for too much longer, and I'm pleased to say we are here to present our first discussion about the HDA to the Human Settlement Portfolio Committee. Now, the presentation is in the pack. You will have a second document which has been distributed this morning, which I want to refer to in the course of the presentation. And it has a page which is another document which I had hoped would have been distributed but is now being copied, which is our first 100-day report. As the former minister told me, my day of appointment was the same day that Barack Obama was appointed. Now, there's no similarity in that, but if he can pass the 100-day report, then perhaps we are too. Let us quickly go through the mandate of the agency, which has been to establish, to facilitate and expedite the development of large-scale, integrated, sustainable human settlements and all the required socio-economic, physical infrastructure. This comes out of the legislation, and all of the mandate issues do have their base in legislation. And I just want to point out a couple of important issues. The first is the issue of facilitating and expediting, which basically means that we're there to support, in particular, provincial and local authorities. The second is that we're talking about large-scale integrated development. We're not there to do the job of those who could and should be doing what they do in a normal course of events. We're about to try to make an impact, which is the mandate that Parliament gave us. Human settlement, I think, doesn't need any more emphasis than the Minister has given in his various public pronouncements. But I just want to then draw your attention to socio-economic infrastructure, because all too often in the settlements that we go and visit today, the socialism is there. It's those issues which are least dealt with that often are what makes, and again, as the Minister said, a house a home. He made the point that when we all leave this place, we don't go house, we go home. And it's that issue that must be guiding some of the discussions that we must have going forward. The four strategic focuses that we hope to get, and I want to make the point that we're only 2 months old, depends on who you talk to. I say we're only 2 months old because I've only been in office full-time 2 months. Other than the department say, well, you were actually appointed in February, whatever. But we've been operating not longer than February and perhaps not on full steam since March, in April, in fact, May. Our first employee started work full-time on the 1st of April. But the four major strategic focuses are ensuring the availability of land, because land is one of the biggest blockages, and that's what we were set up by Parliament to do. Secondly, effectively structuring projects, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Ensuring appropriate government funding flows, easier said than done. In particular, again, if I go back to perhaps two of the big blockages that we face in human settlement development, the one is what is it that we need to put in to make it a home? And the second is around bulk infrastructure, which are the two big blockages in terms of creating effective settlements. And then promoting an appropriate policy and regulatory framework. And again, I'll talk to those. Specifically on the availability of land, we're looking to establish an intergovernmental land inventory and management system, information management system. From there, acquiring and facilitating the acquisition and release of strategically situated land and buildings for development. And finally, supervising and monitoring. Not necessarily implementing, but supervising and monitoring the development of that land.
do the structuring of projects and overseeing the implementation. We would look at trying to facilitate the required capacity, technical skills, and expertise. Coordinating land release and the whole planning exercise in order to develop large-scale settlements. And if you look at any of those settlements, the entry gateway is perhaps the most prominent, but it's not the only one. What they're characterized by is a lack of planning, a lack of foresight around a whole range of issues, including what's the funding requiring, what's the technical support required, what's the timescale involved, all those issues which go to the second point. And finally, facilitating the planning process to ensure the proclamation of land or integrated human settlement. Funding flows, very important for land and building acquisition, for planning and proclamation, for the bulk and internal infrastructure, which is crucial, for the social infrastructure, which is crucial, and we're probably best at doing the cost structure. We're not so good at doing the issues, the three in particular, the three prior to that. And then an appropriate policy and regulatory framework, which will allow us to do what we were set up to do. Let me move on to say what we've done in the first 100 days, and when you get the report, I hope you'll have a chance to go through that in more detail. The Act was promulgated in September last year, and a project team was established, which I headed together with the departmental people under Mr. Shabani's leadership, and there were a number of others in the team. Who did an amazing job, I think, to get the agency set up in record time. The official launch was in March, and at that launch, we launched four pilot projects with a potential of 100,000 units and a total investment of approximately $7 billion, not only coming out of government, but the kind of funding that is being talked about there. And unfortunately, you don't have to have the 100-day report in front of you, but if you look briefly at the one paper that I distributed, you will see a description of the project and the amount allocated to it by the housing budget. The first one is Kaohsiung, the inner city. It's not entirely true that it was a $228 million because that would be allocated to land, not only to inner city projects. But effectively what we're doing there is facilitating the transfer of buildings owned by Transnet currently, moving those into a social housing institution. These negotiations happened before I moved across, so they're going to the Johannesburg Housing Company, which is in negotiation with Transnet and Servcon. And effectively the reason we've chosen that particular project is because of slap bang in the middle of those who know Johannesburg, the big consumer commuter belt around the Hook Street taxi rank and the main station. So it's a very congested area. It's got huge problems around transport, around human settlement, and if you can do something there, you will have made a substantial contribution to sorting out urban management issues in highly congested, highly overcrowded, big commercial area. The next project, Kunubia, is in KwaZulu-Natal. What we've done there is to enter into agreement with the province and the city to do what is probably going to be the largest single development for some time, up to 75,000 units. It's that land that goes all the way from, it's also on the N2, and it's on Mbula down in PE, so we're setting up a string of N2 projects. It will extend all the way from Umhlanga up to Verulam along the M2 past the new airport. The important issue that we've managed to structure there, I think, and this was distributed, and if you look at that page, it's page 7, you will get some sense of the way in which we're trying to work, which is trying to set up a consultative arrangement through an intergovernmental agreement which provides for roles and responsibilities of the different groups involved, including the HDA, which creates in general, this is a model, it will vary from situation to situation, but it creates a political oversight committee which in general will consist of city, province and the HDA, and hopefully either the city or the province will be the leader in that. There will then be a technical steering committee which generally would be led by the city, but it must comprise all of those groupings. And then there will be a whole range of subcommittees working tasking, technical tasking. So you're starting to talk about a correct structuring of a project, which can then go forward with this kind of structure. We're also in the course of, and people are aware that two of the projects we're taking over from Tubadisha are the N2 and Zanabula, both huge projects, both having done very well under very difficult circumstances, I would be willing to argue. But both, in a sense, sufficient around the structuring. And we are currently developing with the city and the province a structuring of that project, which hopefully will take it in its first phase to conclusion, and hopefully the next time we talk, we will be in a position to say to you, we've developed a particular model around the management of mega projects, which a whole range of mega projects in the country will have informed, so we can say this is the way to best do it, learning from the mistakes that there were. So, four pilot projects, again giving rise to saying let's focus on particular major issues. The Northern Cape is another very important area where effectively we're working with a province to create a three-year plan to deal with a min-max decision to overcome the housing backlog in the Northern Cape. It covers a whole range of housing types and urban environments, ranging from cities, if you like, Colesberg, Uppington, Kimberley, two fairly small rural settlements where there are issues to deal with, and that will also give us the experience of dealing with a whole range of different kinds of activities. Kutsong was in the budget there, but it's not one that we've been allocated. The N2 Gateway and Zanabula are ones that we have to take over as per the mandate from the ministry. And then I haven't spoken about Lekalale, which is up in Limpopo. And the interesting thing about Lekalale is that it's a very small urban complex, but it's subject to huge pressures, urbanization pressures, because of the extensive mining activity that is going on in the area in response to both the coal mines that are there and Eskom putting in a new power station. So it gives us the opportunity to do a whole range of economic development activities which will human settlement activities which will link into economic development activities. So those are the four projects. Four leading on to six because of the two vision projects that we've taken over. In March, I was appointed and commenced part-time work, and then we set about setting up intergovernmental protocols with KZN, the Northern Cape, Limpopo, Lekalale, Gauteng, and the City of Johannesburg. And I want to just emphasize that we've had great cooperation in working with people to say, what's the issue, and then what are the roles and responsibilities, and then incorporating that into a document which becomes the foundation of right which everybody can agree to. We have agreements to transfer land and buildings from Serpon to the HDA, and I've talked about that as well. Then in March, putting our house in order, Treasury approved us as Section 3A public entity so we can start trading, which we've done. We've got money in the bank. The board is being gazetted. Again, in the report, which hopefully you'll get in the course of the morning, you will get the names of those people. It's structured in such a way that the Minister of Human Settlements appoints five people. And the balance are appointed by respective ministries or ministers. The chairman is Nkululeko Sawazi. The deputy chairman is Kepa Gordon. The chairman of the audit committee is Gerald Meister. All of those could walk into any institution anywhere in the country and be immediately recognized. So I'm very pleased about that. So the board has been appointed and gazetted, so all of those procedures are in place. The first funding has come through, and in terms of the budget of the Department of Housing, of Human Settlement, I need to get used to that as well, 972 million has been allocated to the projects that I've talked about. At the moment, that money flows via the provinces into the project, and that's an issue I want to note, and an issue that I'll come back to at the end of the presentation. We have concluded land sale agreements with the Western Cape Department of Public Works and the land availability with the Western Cape Department of Local Government. You will have noticed in the press that there has been some discussion about that. You will also notice that the ACA has not been involved in this press discussion at all. It is not for us to get involved in this issue. As far as we're concerned, we have followed all of the correct procedures in terms of our mandate. But I also want to say that we've been engaged in significant discussions with the City of Cape Town, the Province of Cape Town, I've recently been asked, referring to my principals, to meet with the Premier, all in the attempt to resolve this in the interest of housing. So let me say that the issue hopefully is being resolved around what's best for housing in the Western Cape province. And everybody seems to be, while reserving their positions all over the show, which is acceptable and legitimate, everybody seems to be willing to cooperate around that particular issue. I started work full time in May, and in June, the balance of our senior management team came into operation, one of whom is here, Neville Cheney, who is responsible for intergovernmental relations. And we have also now commenced discussions on the arrangements for the takeover of the N2 Gateway and Zanambula project. And these are not easy things to do. They require a whole range of orders around income, around assets and liabilities, contractual obligations, etc. But we will take over as of the 1st of August. We have now had discussions with the staff in both of those projects and have reached arrangements with many of them, not all of them yet. I've made the point already that we have land. We currently have rights to 161 parcels of land, totaling approximately 5,000 hectares. Because of the way in which we acquired them, these are essentially reactive acquisitions. Either we got them via ServCon, getting them from Transnet, passing them on to the HDA, distribution, having some land which is passed on to the HDA, or through the negotiations that occurred around the Western Cape. So we're currently in the process of auditing and evaluating them. That's just a quick overview of the funding as to the budgets that have been approved. That's our internal operating budget. We have an amount of 49.6 million that's been allocated to us. There's an interest charge that income that's allocated there, and then you'll see the fairly broad projections that are estimated for this year. We have no track record to speak of at this point in time, so I put that forward as a projection of what we're intending to do. So let me run and close off, Madam Chair, around some of the important issues that are already going to come out in our short spaces, our short life. Firstly is the acquisition of state-owned land. We would have thought it easy to identify and take over or negotiate it from. People don't necessarily know where their land is, they don't know what land is, they don't know what state it is in many situations. We're in the process now of entering into a land audit in areas where we think are strategically important, of entering into a negotiation with those institutions, some of which will be departments, some of which will be state-owned enterprises. I think that what we would be looking for guidance and support from the committee would be to say, enforce what I understand to be a policy position which says first call on land is for human settlement through the HDA. And we need to get that enforced because it's not always happening, and in some cases it's happening in my view, in an irresponsible way, which is seeing land up in places where it shouldn't. The second big debate is that of at what cost does that land come across. The point has been made publicly. I'm just making the point. The point has been made publicly that the land in the Western Cape was transferred at no cost. I think that's the way it should be. Because one is not looking to profit out of that cost. Where there is a profit, and the agreement provides it, where there is a profit, that is shared with, in fact, 75% of it, not even shared, goes back to the original owner, in this case, the West Cape government. But where there isn't profit, and where it is going to go for low-income communities, for whatever reason within that, whether it be housing or social facilities, my own view, and it's something that we should engage in, is that it should be transferred at the lowest possible cost. We must get out of the equation the idea that you profit in areas of social need because of a whole variety of circumstances. I make this argument that Transnet bought the coal center for 50 million rand. They want to sell it for 600 million. That's a windfall profit, if ever you heard of one. We could turn that into very good social housing for probably 120 million, 200 million. That's the kind of equation, and that becomes affordable to a certain group of people in the Western, in the CBD of Johannesburg. And I think we have to have that debate and get some clarity on it. Coordination with other state departments, I'm sure that's not a new one for you, but we can't work and say we're going to do a development if we can't make sure that the bulk servicing is there and the funding is there in time for before the houses go up. And it's especially around bulk servicing that it's a particular issue. So it's the big infrastructure and the linkages there. Funding flows, again, a very important one, because you will, no doubt, in your careers on this committee, have come across the complaint that the money just doesn't get to where it should be at the right time. And that's something that we will be working very hard to try and get going. And then the last point is a very interesting clause in the Act, which says that the HEA may, with the Minister's approval, declare something called a priority development area. It doesn't say anything more than that. But the potential is starting to emerge. So if, for example, we're working with the Western Cape or the Northern Cape government and we develop a plan for any major strategic intervention, is there not the possibility to then say we will regulate how you do the planning and a whole range of things which currently are subject to legacy delays? They're delays which have occurred in the fiber, they're in the kind of mold of the people who do the planning exercises. And you need to cut them. You need to cut through those delays in particular without undermining the quality and the intention of the original regulation, for example. Now, this is not a new, interesting enough, it's not a new proposal. If you were to go to both advanced countries, Britain has got something similar, or to newly developed countries which have done this very quickly, like Malaysia or Singapore, you'll find that that kind of legislation is there. And that's something that we would be, again, coming to you and looking for your support. So these are kind of major issues that we would need to, that have already come up, and which we would want to engage you and get your comment on, and if agreement is reached, your support going forward. And with that, I'll end and say thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator, for the a very, very informing presentation. As this committee, we were very, very anxious because I think after the act passed, we were very keen to see this agency. Because we were very frustrated of the service delivered, more especially on the affordable housing provision. Now we are very, very we feel very much enthusiasm because we hope there's going to be a difference, and this portfolio committee is going to support whatever measures that are coming up or advices that are coming up to ensure that people get housing. That is our own interest. We don't have any other interest as this portfolio committee. So we will support anything that is going to make sure that our people, more especially the poor of the poorest. So I give this opportunity to the members to engage. Thank you. Honorable Bowman, followed by Honorable Singh, followed by Honorable Figlan, and the Honorable Bula.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much. Also, just to confirm that your presentation to us, I want to say, in setting all this up, I hope there are not going to be three motor cars involved in what you see here. But I understand we will get your first 100-day report before we leave here this morning. So that will be good. I want to just comment about the socio-economic and the integrated way in which we are tackling this and the human settlement involving other than just producing a house. And the problem really arises in the community, and one sees it when people are desperate for housing and when you want to open up an area for parks or you want to open up it, it's just housing that people see. And so, and yet in the long term, it is this integrated approach. And I want to say, this Cornubia, and it's very exciting that we're right at the beginning of this, when one sees overcrowding, and we've spoken a lot about this in the last a few days, in the informal settlement, and this is now opening up a whole lot of housing opportunities for people out of those overcrowded areas where we can't accommodate all the people in the informal settlement. So I think that I am greatly looking forward to working with this particular agency. Our problems have been, and I've picked it up in all the reports I've been reading, is the cooperation between the spheres of government, the problems that have arisen there, and I'm seeing that that is going to be taken care of here. I would just like some further comment, because you didn't really come back to it, and that is the funding via the provinces. And because it also eventually ties up with accreditation to municipalities in taking on, you know, their housing function. So really, my question is been more by way of comment, but I would like to know about the funding via the province. Thank you.
Honourable Singh.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me just, to the Deputy Minister, you'll see this old habit by art. We actually reserved a seat for you this side. And to Mr. Edler, there's a precedence in Parliament that when you do your maiden speech, that we allow you some latitude and we take it easy on you. We actually don't heckle and ask you difficult questions. So I will honor that tradition. Chairperson, the first question I have goes around, and it was under the project management, the facilitation of the required capacity. Now, we spoke about that somewhat yesterday, and the answer came up in reply to a question about the cost of traveling and etc., where the DG indicated that they would spend a relatively large amount of time and effort traveling to various provinces. Now, the HDA or Mr. Edler has indicated here that they will facilitate the required capacity and technical skills. My question, therefore, in this regard is it your intention that you will send teams out to provinces and or metros, or will you, in fact, assist them to build up that capacity locally? The second question is with regard to the Gauteng Red Inner City project, and you mentioned that you were facilitating the transfer
or various buildings that the Johannesburg Housing Company was in. In fact, the transfer is already somewhat in process. Now, my question relates to, and it was something that I expressed when we were debating this piece of legislation, that it would appear that at this point that you're going to be all things to all people. So in a situation like this where there's a process underway and it's working relatively well, would it not be advisable to leave that process and let it continue without you necessarily getting involved? Because there's many other things that's going to require your attention. Then you had a little diagram up there regarding the institutional arrangement and political oversight was right at the top between Metro's province and the National Department. Don't you believe that there should be some political oversight from Parliament? Should be represented in that political oversight body there right at the top? And if you agree with me, how do you think it should be, or somebody or this committee should be represented there, for example? Something that I'm asking perhaps that you forward information sometime in the future, and it's regarding the pilot projects. It's obviously early days, but some of those projects may very well be underway, like the N2 Gateway, for example. I would like, and if the chairperson does agree with me, that at some stage you forward a report, some sort of a detailed report, what the status of those are, over what period you see those pilot projects being completed, the funding mechanism, you've given a budget there, is that over 3 years, is it over 5 years, something like that. And that immediately brings me to one of your concerns, the flow of funds from the provinces. Is it at this point envisaged that you will get the funds incrementally as the work gets done, or will the funds be transferred, or is that what you'd like to see happen, from the provinces in one tranche? Then lastly, Chairperson, a question regarding you transferring land from various other spheres of government, state-owned land. Is there a cost involved from transferring it from whatever department to the HDA? Because at some point, I would imagine, when a project is being planned and it's going to go ahead, it's been developed, that land would have to be transferred back to their province. So is there a cost? Are we not going to duplicate costs that way? You know, it's one thing for you to sort of keep control, perhaps, and over land. It's another. If there's a cost involved where you're going to have to transfer it two or three times, then I think we need to relook at it. And then I want to touch on the cost of land that you mentioned from, you know, if it belongs to one sphere of government or one department, it's state-owned land. I cannot see why, in fact, it should be paid for if it comes to the HDA. Because my personal viewpoint in this regard is, and I'd like to take the Western Cape issue as an example without going into detail, but ultimately, you know, land is something you can't use a piece of land for housing in Gauteng, for example. It's not something you can take out of the province. So ultimately, this province or the people in this province should benefit by the development of that land, provided that it's going to be used for housing, as you've indicated. So, yes, you've stated your views in terms of having to pay for it, and I think it's something you should share with this committee and perhaps other committees in Parliament that we should take up. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine will be very short and sweet. Firstly, let me say good morning to everybody. My question is about how much land do we have available for this department? And since we have shortage of skills, people, how do you plan in getting the right skills to proceed with this project? Those are my takes. Thank you.
Honourable Kula.
Thank you, Chair. I think that we have been adequately covered, but in view of the skills at various municipalities that lack the pertinent skills, I appreciate the fact that the development will be based on the magnitude of the size of the homes that you will be producing. But you made reference to underfunding on top structure, which will be seen to be best to deliver. How would you deal with the problem where the challenges arise with bulk services, and you would find on one hand that you can acquire the land and deliver the top structure, but there are constraints on delivering on bulk services. The other area is concerned on the page of issues and on the bullet point 5, creation of priority development areas. Apart from the magnitude of land that you would acquire, how would you deal with situations where small municipalities have these constraints of not acquiring land and they have to pursue the line of expropriation, which causes unnecessary delay and adding to the hardship of those that are living in the informal settlements? Thank you.
Over to
Perhaps I can try and answer all these questions by taking just one step back, which is to say that there needs to be adequate preparation and consultation around these issues. Now, I'm sure you've been told that often. But if you are able to come forward with a proposal which has been adequately canvassed with those people who need to make a contribution, it should have taken into account a range of the problems that you have dealt with. So, for example, if you need to have dealt with the question of capacity in a local authority or a small local authority, the structure of the intergovernmental relations memos that we have been developing have a list of roles and responsibilities, and within that list is a very clear statement about the even as well capacitated a city as Isigwini is saying, we would like from you A, funding for a project manager for our project, and B, support for the planning process. So there would be a list of roles and responsibilities which will have been workshopped through. I suspect that one of the things that we're going to perhaps butt heads on is the tension, and it's a good tension, but I think we need to recognize it, the tension between getting delivery out as quickly as possible and doing it in the most effective way, which requires planning. You will find that often shortcuts have been taken because of the one trumping the other, if you like. In the four projects that we've been working with, we have been working in such a way that institutions have been canvassed on their views, roles and responsibilities have been developed and allocated, and we have been looking to develop, for example, either the capacity or the identification of, in the case of Kimberley, and the biggest problem in Kimberley at the moment, in Larata Park, which is one of the projects that is starting to become infamous, is the hold in the hold-up, and the hold-up is in bulk services. So a strategy is then developed right at the beginning to say, how do we deal with bulk services? But let me also make the point, and I think I'm probably going to withdraw into the new boy defense quite often. But as a new boy in this kind of area, I have been both fascinated and taken by the fact that there is actually a logic to intergovernmental framework and the pace at which government moves. I think we tend to forget sometimes that, in my view, that you're not dealing with things which don't have consequences. You're dealing with issues which have large, vast amounts of money and do have consequences. You've got to think those things through properly. And so I'm not as stressed as perhaps one should be about taking time over doing something as long as it's done properly, and the result is not, you know, the amount of money we're spending on rectification around the country could have been so easily avoided if somebody had said, do the foundations properly. Nobody said that. So it's that kind of framework that we would like to create, Madam Chair. Now, just to get back to the specific question, the issue of funding flows and underfunding for bulk. Again, this will be a tension that you have to manage more than me. As the HDA, we would like as much control over the money so that we can account for it, we can spend it, and then report back on it. The fact that it goes through a variety of channels at the moment, if you look at the way the funding flows occur in the N2, it's no wonder that people get frustrated. The money comes in from national, it goes to the province, the contractor then has to submit a document to Felicia in this case. To Felicia has to send it to head office has to send it to the province sends it back to Felicia, then it's just ridiculous. So what you're trying to do is get the quickest possible effective way in which there is control. And I add that second point because you obviously want to keep that format. So from our point of view, and we have started to engage with the Department and Treasury on this, it makes sense to put the money that is allocated to HDA projects, it makes sense to put them with the HDA, and that's what we will be arguing. I hope we get it with your support. And it's for that fundamental reason. Put it where it's most effectively used without delay and under control. And that would also happen with, for example, funding for bulk infrastructure. If we could find a way of making sure that the funding is properly allocated and then flows, that would obviously be best for everybody concerned. How we do this, I'll be honest, I don't yet know. Hopefully in the next 6 to 12 months, I'll be able to come back with an answer. Around capacity, again, we have taken quite careful cognizance of the need to develop capacity in the areas that we are operating. We've been very careful to work with the local or provincial authorities and only support where they have requested or where the need has become very clear and they have articulated that need. Where, for example, in the Northern Cape, we are now appointing a consultant to develop a 3-year plan. In fact, we have required that consultant work with a locally based person so that there may be a national appointment, but there will be a local person who is qualified and who can work and grow into that environment. So, again, on the capacity level, it's about trying to identify the need and then work with that need as we are able to do. I do want to say that I am very pleased about the caliber of people who have come into the HDA. I think at the moment we've really got an 18. I hope, and we will work on a coordinating national platform and we'll try and put in place project managers who work with local or provincial capacity. And so far that model seems to have been accepted in the areas that we've worked and accepted with open arms. It's taken time. So in the Northern Cape we've been through 3 or 4 workshops. It's the same, right through the country. It's been taking a little bit of time to do. On the issue of land and transfers, again, one does what is most appropriate to the effective working of the project and in compliance with the statutory requirements. So specifically on the Transnet transfers, because of PFMA requirements, we are having to probably go on long leases with, in this case, the JSC. We're requiring Treasury approval for something that I never knew existed, which was called a financial lease, but we have just put in. You can put pressure on Mr. Shabani. He got a letter yesterday saying, please can you expedite us getting Treasury approval for this. So one would work with whatever is most effective. In the case of the Western Cape land, for example, we, in the case of one parcel, a portion of the land, there are two agreements, but in the case of the one, just an example, we actually don't take transfer of the land. We retain the development rights for the land, under the supervision of the province in this case, but the land only gets transferred when the end beneficiary has been identified. So again, it'll be
trying to do what makes sense in the at the least cost around. So on the question of Parliament and its involvement in the activities that we're creating, I think the principle has been who's responsible for what. So the national department has a role because of its particular insights. If it is felt that there is a role for Parliament, then from my point of view, I don't see any particular problem. As long as it remains within an accepted framework, we have in many situations floating mandates, and that causes havoc because you have people coming in and you don't know where or how, and as long as people come into an agreed structure. So if Parliament and the portfolio committee is going to come in, they must come in at the level of the technical of the political oversight committee, and they must account to that committee. They may report back, of course, to this, but nobody is the point I'm making. Nobody should be able to operate outside of the mandates that have been agreed and that are in general legally there. But I leave that for you to handle. The question of a report, hopefully you'll see in the 100 days report the kind of, it's a little skimpy on detail because that's where we're at, but there is some detail in that, and that should give you more insight, and we will continue to supply you with reports as I think we're required to do, and as we would want to do. I don't have an answer yet to the question of how much land is available, and we will progress on that one. And then we'll make that available. And it's not only, you know, there's a very famous simile which is saying that if you're talking about a great company, it's in a book called Good to Great. If you talk about a great company, you've got to have the right people in the right seats on the bus. Okay. We want the right land in the right place in the country. So it doesn't make sense to just go for land. You want to be going for land where it's appropriate. I hope I've covered with all the elements, Madam Chair. If not, I can try again.
It's a follow-up question. Okay.
Yes, two questions that I believe I haven't had an answer to. One was the comment about leaving the Johannesburg Housing Company with the transfer of the buildings that they're currently busy with. That you shouldn't get too involved in everything. If they're doing a proper job of it, let them go ahead and complete that. And the other one was the question of the funds that you do have a problem with that resides with the province that has to come across. Is it still going to come across incrementally or in one tranche?
Do you have a response on that?
Chair, specifically on that, the land transfers. What we're structuring with the JHC, the building transfer, there's a little bit of work to be done in terms of the policy framework because we have to get Treasury approval. Once that's created, then it'll be easy for them to go on with the actual transfer, and they will then enter into, it'll probably be 30-year leases with the HDA, with sort of safeguards about if they don't run according to the plan that they have got approved, then we have the right to take it back. But once that's been through, certainly in terms of the management, we will not be involved in the management at all. They will just run it according to an oversight plan that has been, and we, I think the agreement provides for an annual report, and we will just follow an oversight position. In terms of the funding, again, just bring it on. The more you can preach our coffers, the better. So our preference would obviously be to get the money in, particularly so that you can release... let me make this contrast. It seems to me that projects which are successful are properly capitalized. Projects which aren't are drip-fed. The funding model, with due respect, in government and amongst donors, is the drip-feed model. The JHC was properly capitalized up front. South Train has been properly capitalized up front, the Roads Agency, all these kind of examples which have got international reputation were properly capitalized. And I hope we're going to be in that situation.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps I could just introduce myself. My name is Joe Muglu. I'm a member and also a member of the Independent Democrat. I would like to elaborate on the question of creation of priority development areas. By definition, I would like to know what is the view of HDA when it comes to the priority development areas per se. Very important also is that we believe in affordable housing. And also together with that, I would like to know the role of HDA in terms of affordable housing in its attempts to allocate or assist our people into urban areas. You have the old system whereby people are being dumped into a specific area. If you look to the N2 gateway, you'll find there's no close schools in the vicinity. There's no soccer fields. There's no shopping centers and everything that goes together. So we need to bring our people and integrate them into urban areas. And also I see that the slide there is also a absence of the wetlands, specifically regard to the Western Cape, and also the problems that we have in terms of that. Thank you, Chair.
Madam Chair, it may be useful to clarify the funding flows. As is currently the practice, we discussed at length yesterday the allocation formula to some degree. The allocations out of the grant are appropriated to provinces. It's a conditional grant to provinces. Now, in the case where we have prioritized certain projects, those projects are located within provinces, and therefore the funds were appropriated to the province. Now, members should be aware, the HDA Act was only passed in September. The national budget was presented to the House early in February. You possibly could not appropriate money to an aid entity that is not operational. You couldn't. So these are matters that, going forward, we are in discussions with National Treasury around the proper flow of those funds in respect of projects wherein the HDA is involved. I'm just saying, Madam Chair, the reality is that it is a little premature to preempt the conclusions. We would want to be able to exhaust the appropriate constitutional legal requirements to arrive at this conclusion. It does make absolute sense from a modeling point of view. That's how the HDA is structured. But we have to go through this, rather exhaust all these legal requirements, in particular constitutional requirements in this regard. The intention of the priority development zones or areas as provided for in the Act. The Act goes further to state that in these priority development zones, the HDA would need to implement fast-tracking development measures. Those measures are yet to be determined. Certainly, the space is available. In time, the HDA, and I don't intend to speak for them, but in time, the HDA will introduce a package of fast-tracking measures that would be applied in those priority development areas. So it is still a work in progress. I'm sure the committee would enjoy the benefits of interacting with those provisions. The ministry is yet to consider those fast-tracking measures for regulation. So it's work that is in progress, and when everybody's ready, those should come out going forward. And therefore, that would attend to questions such as the quality of settlements that you are producing. I think I note the concerns from the honourable member that the quality of settlements sometimes is found wanting. And that's essentially the shift that we are pursuing along with the HDA and various other institutions involved in the built environment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Chair, I just want to follow up on the comment about the quality of the environment, because we must understand that the current situation comes about as a result of pressures. And if we are to resist those pressures, which have long-term consequences, it's really incumbent upon everybody around here to help us in ensuring that those things, because quality comes as two things. It comes as it requires planning, and there's a cost involved. And if you take the actual cost, let's take electricity. If we take the actual cost of a solar heater, for example, it's a very high capital cost, but the long-term impact is obviously greater. We have to do that total cost-benefit analysis. And quite frankly, where it's justifiable, we're going to need your support, because these are political debates. They're not technical debates. When we're saying we want to protect this land for schools, it's a political debate that occurs at the level of the community. When we say that we want you to hold on because we're looking for a solution around foundation, again, those are issues where you've just got to balance the tension. So I just want to highlight that we can talk easily about quality, but it's not our current operational mindset. And I just want to note that.
Thank you very much. I think now we have exhausted our debate or engagement to this one. I'm not going to give you now. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give you. I'm just suggesting that if it's a planning issue, can after the meeting, can meet with them because of time now. It's something to level now. Quarter to 11. Do you think in this meeting we still have 1, 2, 3, 4 constitutions to present? Okay, just raise it. Don't expect, just be short.
If necessary, I'll put it in a written question form. But Chairperson, the concern when Mr. Edler mentioned now that JHC will sign a 30-year lease, for example, leads me to the conclusion that those buildings will ultimately then belong to the HDA because they're signing a lease. Now, surely the same is not going to happen with other developments. The HDA will act as a guardian in terms of that land and its usage, but they're not going to, like with the buildings, take some sort of ownership of it.
No, I think most of the issues are going to engage in on ourselves as the committee. We still to engage. So let's leave them for now. Not next, it's NSDRC.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Komuso Mashobo, the acting CEO for NSDRC. I'm with the CFO for NSDRC, Kodinso. We will run through the presentation, noting that we are already running behind schedule. Most of the slides that we have provided will be for information. I'll just run through the most critical slides. Members should also note that we distributed, I hope it has been distributed, another pack to replace the budget part or budget portion of the presentation, because we received our actual report after submitting the initial presentation. So we had to rework on the document. I'll skip all this in information on the... on the preliminary issues concerning our organization and hone on to the objects of council, which are outlined in the Act that establishes NHBRC, the Housing Consumer Protection Measures Act. This is where we derive our mandate. And we have lifted the object of council directly from the Act, which states that we are to regulate the home building industry and to provide protection to housing consumers in respect of the failure of home builders to comply with their obligations in terms of the Act. We also establish and promote ethical and technical standards in the home building industry. The Act provides that we improve structural quality in the interest of housing consumers and the home building industry, to also present the interest of housing consumers by providing warranty protection against defects in new homes, to also promote housing consumer rights and to provide housing consumer information, and to communicate with and to assist home builders to register in terms of the Act, to further assist home builders through training and inspection to achieve and maintain satisfactory technical standards of home building, to further regulate insurers as contemplated in Section 23.9A of the Act, and in particular to achieve the stated object of this section in the subsidy housing sector. From this object, we translate strategic objectives, some of which are to develop a one-stop-shop business model for stakeholders and customers. As NHBRC, we also strive to provide optimal service delivery within approved time frames, to lead in supporting government in meeting its subsidy housing business initiatives, and to enhance corporate image and identity in line with the organizational vision. We further strive to strategically and effectively manage the valuable final products of council and to establish and maintain strategic partnership with all relevant stakeholders. We also are a market leader, or we are aiming to become a market leader in knowledge management in the home building industry, and strive to grow and sustain the warranty fund since we are a warranty provision organization. We further ensure optimal compliance with legislative framework and ensure efficient and effective resource management, as well as implementation of optimal corporate governance, and we provide a strategic leadership and effective management in order to achieve all the above. Further objectives for NHBRC is to create the internal capacity. I think this is a repetition. In brief, here I have provided, or I am just showing our performance in terms of the valuable final product of council in the 2008-09 and the previous year, 2007-08 financial year, in terms of registration, the performance is as indicated here. The 2008-09 financial year, members will realize that in terms of registration, we did not perform according to target. The registration performance was below. Renewal was also slightly below the target. Enrollment and late enrollment, complaints, inspections, and all the other valuable final products except for inspections, where we exceeded the target. The reason why performance started to decline in 2008 is the external economic factors. And in the first quarter of 2009, I must indicate that we have been performing very, very low below the target because of these drastic external negative economic factors which have affected the housing industry. In terms of subsidy performance, project enrollment for 2008-09, performance was very, very low as well. We had projected to enroll 124,000 projects. We ended up enrolling 67,000 projects. In the home enrollment as well, the performance was almost half the expected or the targeted percentage. In terms of training, we trained fewer home builders than the number that we had anticipated due to the fact that the tenders were issued quite late in the financial year and training left behind. That's just a chart on performance versus target, where performance is reflected in red and target was in blue. Remedial work for last year, 2008-09, we spent a total of 5.2 million in remedial work, and a total spent on professional fees is reflected there as 500,000. Other areas where we spent our accommodation, foundation, substructure, superstructure, and we did not spend anything on roof leaks because we only started covering the roof leaks last year. If we were to compare, okay, I think I've covered this one, and moving on to training per province, we have trained home builders in various provinces or in all the provinces. That reflects the actual performance as opposed to the targeted training. I indicated that the training performance was lower because of the late appointment of service providers. That's your training of home builders in the year 2008, target versus actual. And if you were to compare the trainees in terms of male and female per module, in the bricklaying module, there were more male than females, and construction management, finance for non-financial managers, painting, clustering, plumbing, project management and roofing. We know that this is a male-dominant environment, but we have endeavored to include more women, as you can see. There's a chart that indicates male to female participation. For the MPF period, these are our priorities as NHGRC. We intend spending more time and money training and educating home builders, women, youth, and historically disadvantaged individuals. I must indicate that these priorities may be affected by the fact that due to the economic downturn, there is a decrease in our revenue generation, which has now affected our cash flow, as a result of which we are now beginning to do disinvestment, the details of which Courtney will give later on. So those may, in some way, affect the priorities that we have for NTM. We intend increasing housing consumer awareness, increasing interaction and support of the Minister's vision of sustainable and integrated human settlement. We also intend promoting housing innovative technologies and quality standards in the home building industry. Members may be aware that we have this innovation technology hub in Soshanguve. We are now establishing a similar hub in Western Cape, and KZN has also approached NHGRC to assist them in establishing an innovation hub. We want to facilitate strategic sourcing of building materials and products as one of the mandates that we're given by MINMEC, and we want to explore the possibility of sourcing technical staff, which is a scarce skill beyond our borders, because we have realized that it is very, very difficult to attract and retain technical skills. I'll skip that one. This also outlines some of the challenges that we are faced with as an organization. In addition to the economic downturn, we are seeing there is insufficient appropriate strategic relationships. In particular, we are improving our relationships with municipalities to better our delivery. There are constraints as a result of legislation, as a result of which we are reviewing the very act, and we are also updating the regulations. the language-based enrollment fee structure. I think this will be further elaborated on by Courtney later, relating it to the actual report. The latest one is actually telling us that our enrollment fees need to be revised. There's inadequate marketing or communication, and we are working on this as an organization. There's an increased staff turnover, especially in terms of their care skills, hence the strategy to try and go beyond the boundaries of our country to solve skills. The challenge of unenrolled homes by registered home builders still exists, and we are working on improving enrollment figures by these registered home builders to ensure that they keep and they comply to the legislation. There is also an aspect of understatement of enrollment value in some instances, especially in the non-subsidy environment, where at the point of enrollment, people understate or the builder understates the enrollment value. So we are working on this issue in collaboration with municipalities, looking at the approval values at the point of approving the building plans. Liquidation and bankruptcy of registered home builders remains a risk to us because as soon as the home builder has liquidated and is bankrupt, it becomes very difficult to follow them up, especially if they have to go back and do the rectification, as a result of which we then have to draw from the warranty fund. In terms of provincial involvement, I must say we have made strides in improving our relationship to the provincial housing department. We are now assisting them in geotechnical investigations to ensure that they submit adequate information for enrollment purposes. We assist provincial departments also in forensic investigation, and this forensic investigation is to quantify the extent of non-compliance and the extent of quality of houses that were built between 1994 and 2002, those that were not enrolled by NHBRC, which now have to be rectified. And in some provinces, we are helping with project managing the rectification programs. We are engaging provinces in training of the youth, women, and unemployed, and as well as people with disabilities. We have embarked on a process of proactive enrollment of projects based on the provincial 209-2010 multi-year development plan, where we go to the provincial department and set with staff to ensure that enrollment process is expedited. The new grading system, because this has been passed, we are implementing the new grading system. The impact that the grading system is going to have in our revenue generation is negative, but it is going to improve, or it is going to motivate the good builders to continue building better, and it is going to motivate those who have not acquired better grades to improve. In terms of governance, we are governed by council, and there are various committees of council. Administratively, this is our structure where we have the CEO, CO, and we have four divisions. And in terms of location of offices, we have nine provincial offices, and we have various satellite offices in some of the provinces. We intend spreading this to other provinces like Northern Cape, where we anticipate coming up with mobile offices to ensure that we are accessible and visible to our clients. Okay.
independent chairperson. What the budget for 2010 budget 26, the revenue aspects of the NHBRC. We have two types of accounting. We basically have the annual financial statement accounting, and at the bottom of the screen you see we utilize a thing called IFRS 4. Our budgets, we do that annually through an actuarial report. So our budgets are actually done on a conventional accounting method. You know that we follow GRAP, GARP, and all the acts, and you find at the bottom of that slide there is no IFRS 4. The effect on IFRS 4 is basically reserve that we have to require. We have to retain in the company or to meet future claims and unearned premiums. And you see, those are the kind of premiums that the reserves will retain specifically in terms to meet future claims against the NHBRC. The whole budget basically, because this is done once a year and it's a projection, we do not include it in our normal management accounts. Our revenue assumptions are in terms of the Act, we're going to go through them, they can be read. Effectively that we get a maximum fee of 34,000 for any home of 5 million. And you see that the income is on a stepped approach. The late enrollment fee is more like a little penalty, only 592 rand, and maybe that's one area we have to look at it, because people who are not complying with the law should maybe be punished a little bit more than 592 rand. The enrollment distribution in the non-subsidy set, you find that at the next year we're looking at enrolling 55,897 units. They're spread over all of the provinces. When we get these figures, we basically deal with the Department of Statistics, and they have a project, and they give us guidelines on how many building plans have been passed. And we go, remember this was done in June last year, so it's June on June, and that's where we look at our trends for outside, and we look at the building plans all that passed, and we get an idea of what's going to be done. It's quite a lot down from in the non-subsidy sector for two reasons. One, we know the interest rates went up. Two, we know that banks decided they wanted 100% loans, but they wouldn't give 100%, they wanted 75%, they wanted 25% but deposit, and they gave 75%. It's interesting this morning on the TV, they actually said that certain banks are moving back to budget of 100%. And I think maybe with the reduction in interest rates, we could see this flow coming back, but not this year. It'll take time before the contractors can actually climb into projects again. What that equates to is the registration tax. You see that we're looking at generating enrollments of 4.8 million. The technical L is 9.9, and you look, there's the builder grading of 10.9, it's a negative. So we are projecting income for the HBRC of 458 million in the forthcoming year. The revenue variance, against our closing this year estimated results that closed at the end of April, we find that against the projected budget, the biggest variance you'll see there is in the whole home enrollment. You notice that we only did 372 million, and even though we are budgeting 448, it shows an increase. But the 372 was a big problem because that is against a budget of, it was 500, I'll show it to you now. The subsidy market, we charged 1% for project enrollment and 0.75% for the home enrollment fee. The distribution of the number of enrollments that we work with, the provincial departments in order to get the number of enrollments. We're expecting 101,000 home enrollments, and we're expecting 145,000 project enrollments. Remember, this is the kind of enrollments we're expecting to go through the NHBRC and not the ones on PHP, People's Housing Process, PHP. The subsidy income, the 145,000, will generate 51 million in NHBRC, and in the home enrollment, it will generate 98 million. Give us a total subsidy income of 150 million. If we look at we had this one before. So it's duplication slide. Why it's duplicated is I wanted to bring it to the second part of the graph. If we look at the second half where we've got the subsidy side, you notice that in the budget we only had 27 million, we only had 45 million for the project enrollment. And now if you look at where we are going to, we're now projecting 51 and 98. It's a substantial increase in delivery in the subsidy market. And again, we invested 23 million up on home enrollments, and we basically 53 million up on the purchase loan. That is our projection and basically our ability and our hope that we can support in the subsidy market. Revenue trends that you see over the year in the non-subsidy is quite disturbing. You see that if you take it, the actual 207, 208 is the blue. You take the estimated income is the purple or red, and you're looking, we're only projecting next year for the yellow. It's a massive trend. Is that showing what's happening in the market out there at the moment? This massive fall. When we did this budget, we were looking at a projection of about 20% down. The January and January stats from the performance of statistics showed nearly a 48% drop, and we are expecting just about a 45% drop in actual figures at the moment. So these budgets may be a little bit on the high side. If you look at the subsidy market here, our trend is increasing and our delivery. And obviously with the interest rates coming down, you find our investments peak. We are drawing money out of investments, and we have the slide down as more basic ground due to the interest rates that are falling at this point in time. Expenditure, a quick review. We have measures, these are for the risk expenditures. The accreditation expenditure we use to accreditate home builders before we actually take them onto our books to make sure they are viable. The inspection fees is the fees that we incur in inspecting homes, and there's a number of inspections that we will do on every type of home. Inspection fees that we expect to do is 252,000 based on the enrollment, and that will cost us 71.8 million rand. On the subsidy market, we're expecting, based on the number of units that have been enrolled, we expect to do 101,000 inspections. That's going to cost us 50.6 million rand. I'll come back to it as well. Over and above the 50.6, we still have 48 people employed in our company who internally will do inspections. The major variances against the period operating costs, you'll find that the actual 208, 209 to 209 budget, the inspections on non-subsidy is down, and the reason basically for that is the lower number of units. Inspections in the subsidy has gone up. You see last year there was no expenditure. It's a new commitment for the NHGRC to put a whole lot more money into that area. The fixed expenses are virtually in line. More of inflation, or actually lower than last year. Special projects for the ministerial, we gave undertaking to support the minister's office last year with 150 million. We have reserved that in the current books, and next year is basically more training, and any special projects has dropped to 27. So 150 net has been ring-fenced for ministerial projects. Employment costs, even though they look up, they're basically in line with inflation. Remember, the actual figure doesn't have the vacancies in, but in the budget you have vacancies, and you have certainly the challenges in the budget side in that you've got the engineering staff that we just can't place, and we can't fill some of those subpositions. The rest of the thing, the budget contract is important. The last year, that even though we only budgeted, we actually only spent 17 million on emerging contractor, we have budgeted for the 36 million for training for this year. The major experiences, this is actually the budget for budget year on year. I don't want to spend time on it, just to highlight to you that your biggest problem there is you'll see the ministerial project is down, but I've explained that because it actually because of the 150 that it has been ring-fenced and will not be carried forward. Emerging contractor training, I think you've seen that already. That's what we have budgeted for. Those are the type of courses. It's a 36 million rand. Strategic additional expenditure that was included in the budget this year are two big things. Inspection fees again, to bring it to your attention, that we're putting a lot more effort into the subsidy market. We have 48 internal subsidy inspectors over and above that. And we're now looking at our, as Kamorta said earlier on, the extra 2.4 million for the mobile officers in order to be seen, which is not the same. But that's just a pictorial graph of the trends over the year of the training expenses, operating costs. I won't go through that. This is a quick summary of the income statement. We are projecting this year a profit of 314 million. The budget next year is 285 million. There's not really big variances. I think all we have to bring out is the total revenue is becoming a problem. The capital budget is 20.3 million. The big expenditure there would be the Innovation Hub, which is to ensure that we open up a laboratory to do actual testing of materials. That's what the 5 million for. And then you'll see motor vehicles are surprised, not even buying machines, brings anything. Those are the mobile offices. Right, the balance sheets. So primarily there's no big shakes about that. I mean, it's in line and it's disclosed to you from the income statement. Cash flow. What I'm getting to the House's attention at this point in time is that we are now beyond the first 2 months, we're 2 months into the budget. I mentioned earlier on that we only budget a 20% reduction in income. We are now running at a 45% reduction. I want to show you just quickly what is happening. If you look at the 5 period from January to May, can you notice in April and May, the green bar charts, that difference between the red line and the green line. First of all, that green line should be above the red line. That's where we are getting the 48% drop in enrollment. So it's very clear from our cash flow. The trouble is the difference between the red line and the green is a 13 million for the last 2 months, just a 13.4 million per month difference. At the moment, the NHBRC is unable to fund its operations. And it has to now split the revenue. Remember that the warranty fund, even though it's X, there is money in there because not every rand goes for the warranty. So the warranty fund requires a billion and a half, but there is operating money. We will maybe have to in future split it to show, well, this must be put aside, we can never touch. And so there is money we have to direct with interest in that, which is for operations in crises like this. And of course, but the good times will come back. Actuarial valuation, quite disconcerting at the moment based on the current changes in the market. The current one that came out basically says we have need the provisions which showed you right in the beginning of the slide with the technical provisions of 848 million rand. That is what we have to reserve account in terms of IFRS 4. The second line is becoming a problematic now. In our opinion, the enrollment fees charged shall not be adequate for the expenses and claims for both the non-subsidy and subsidy houses. The first time this has happened, I think it's basically because they're protecting the declining markets and the fixed cost today. This is a serious element that, as it's management in NHBRC, we have to focus on and look at certain cost reductions and certain trying to do things smarter. Deliver the same thing, cover the same risk, but just do things smarter. The new council and the management are working on a whole lot of initiatives at the moment to address this in order to get rid of this negativity. To sum it up, what they're saying on enrollment fees now is the subsidy sector that for every enrollment taking our fixed costs, remember we've got the extra 51 million rand in, so for every house we enrolled in the subsidy sector, it costs the NHBRC 1,161 rand, more than the enrollment fee. And for the non-subsidy sector at the moment, based on our inspections, accreditations and fixed costs, it's now costing us 686 more than what we enrolling. So it's a serious change, it's a challenge that comes up, and we just have to relatively look at different models, specifically in the fixed cost area. Thank you.
Thank you very much, NHDRC. Time for engagement.
Chairperson, thank you. I am concerned. I'm worried. I am very worried. You know, during the good times, when we see the excesses, then there's no mention that an enrolled house costs more than the enrollment. Then it seems to work fine. We're running into problems, and we seem to identify that as a problem now. And the other big concern I've got, Chairperson, and let me just add here that I think we've done it before, we often do it. We ask that these reports be given to us, certainly not even 24 hours, but at least a week before the time. I couldn't follow half of what was going on here. I couldn't digest it. It makes it difficult for us to engage. But the one thing, and I don't know where it is here because there's no page numbers, but the complaints. There's a big, big difference between the number of complaints and the conciliations, which means there may very well be outstanding risks in terms of repairs that need to be done. But there's a big difference. I don't know what the percentage is even, but it's something like 2,000 odd complaints. I can't find the slide. And a very minute number that's actually been where conciliation has taken place. So there is the one concern. Then, Chairperson, as I've done, in fact, last year I had the opportunity. You know, one of our objects of council, and we perhaps took too much time there to go through the objects, and I think there were 12 strategic objectives or something like that, but one of them is to represent the interests of housing consumers. I have in my office at this moment something that came through 2 days ago that's been dragging on for the last 2 years, where NHBRC has simply not responded. The people have actually lost their house. They are bankrupt just about now because the house has to be demolished. And they've had no feedback from NHBRC. Now, a year ago, and the Deputy Minister will remember this, I brought a similar situation in a meeting such as this to their attention. And then it also dragged on for 2 years, but it took another 7 months to resolve it. And you'll notice somewhere in here they talk about very high accommodation costs, and I assume that is to accommodate people whilst their homes are being repaired. Now, the one that I brought to them last year resulted in that family having to be accommodated for another 7-8 months in a hotel. Now, it is unnecessary that we have to get to that stage, because if you take 2 years, the defect in that house just gets worse, and you eventually have to demolish. So it's something that is of concern. In fact, I found the conciliations here that, oh no, that was, yeah, 1,200 complaints and 186 have been dealt with. Simply unacceptable, Chairperson. Then, in terms of the last slide, I cannot understand. I would imagine there is some sort of a correlation between the number of enrollments and your number of inspections, because it's related. And I do accept that there are some fixed operating costs, such as buildings, and whether you've got 2 enrollments or 200, you still have to pay that cost. But why is there such a big difference? Because the enrollments have reduced in terms of your outflow compared to the inflow. So there should be, within reason, some sort of correlation. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable comments?
Chairperson, I must also record my own great concern with this report that we have in front of us. I too would have liked a bit more time to look at it. It's extremely difficult just being presented with all these figures. Just, I would like to refer to the performance and the targets in the 2007 and then the targets in the performance 2008-09. It seems to me, and I'm working purely from what is in front of me here, is that our performance, going from our performance in 2007-2008, and then we set a target for 2008-2009, and then the performance, we're down on all of that. And we're down even on the performance in 2007-2008. Now, I think the alarm bell should also be ringing in relation to what we are presenting in, you know, by way of these figures. It just is not making, and we talk about the external economical factors. Now, this seems to go way back to 2007-2008, and our economic downturn has only just recently started to happen, so I just like some idea of what it is we're actually referring to here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My concern is about this action the NHBRC would like to take of punishing. What is that mean, punishing? Because I would like an institution to say they are going to punish people for not enrolling their houses. And I think they have to look what are the causes, possible causes, that result into underestimation of enrollment value. because to me, I'm still not convinced that NHDRC is doing enough to make the public aware of their activities. What they do, they publicize their activities in the, you know, this Sawubona magazine. We'll see them there. But the majority of our people, we'll see them in the newspapers. The majority of our people, more especially in the rural areas, they don't have access to those media. So, I'm worried about their step to say they want to increase the enrollment. Instead, I should think they rather decrease it for a certain level, because they intensify their awareness program. They don't go to the rural areas, these people. They just sit in Devon. They just sit in Eastern Cape, I mean in East London. So the rural areas are not catered for. The small towns, they are not catered for. So I have a concern about that. And then the last one, I wanted to make a correction to say George is not in the Eastern Cape. George is in the Eastern Cape. Just a correction. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, sir. In terms of publicity, I must indicate that we, if you remember in one of the slides, we have indicated that we are working on that. And we've embarked on massive roadshows starting from February this year. We've covered 7 provinces thus far. And we've mentioned that we are addressing the issue of accessibility and disability through our satellite offices, including mobile offices that we intend directing in the first provinces like Northern Cape. The issue on punishing people for not enrolling. My colleague may have used a very harsh word talking about punishment, but the act allows us to ensure that people comply. We have to find ways of encouraging people to comply with the act, because no house should be built in this country without enrollment. The factors that may lead to underestimating or reducing the value at enrollment point, what the beneficiaries and the contractors normally do is to want to pay less enrollment fees. Notwithstanding the fact that at the end of the day, should there be any structural defect, we will have to look at the value of the property as we do the remedial work. So at the point of enrollment, no one wants to pay enrollment fee. Therefore, there's a tendency to try and find ways of under-enrolling with the purpose of saving and not understanding that they are short-circuiting themselves. The point later when they need or should they need any remedial work done on the house, we will look at the enrollment value. The correlation between enrollment and inspection. I think what we need to realize is at the point of enrollment, or a person may enroll a house today and they may build in 6 months, 1 year, or in 18 months' time. So what we are inspecting today is what is being built today. That may not necessarily have been enrolled in this financial year. That is why there is a likelihood that you will not find a direct correlation between the enrollment figures and the inspection figures. Representing interest of the housing consumers. The issue in the Western Cape about the house that has not been attended to, I'm not aware of that. We will take the details and addresses as soon as we get the details thereof. The difference between complaints and conciliation. Okay. you will always find more complaints than conciliation because the type of complaints that come to our office are different, most of which are to public. Any home builder who sees anything that looks like a threat, they come to our offices. We record that as part of communication and part of education that we give to our consumers. Not all the complaints that are received translate into real complaints, because once we receive complaints, we have to check whether they are real structural related or are they in terms of the structural defect, and it's only those that relate to the structural defect that are taken to the conciliation stage and to a remedial process. So there will always be that discrepancy between the number of complaints and conciliation. In terms of the report that was distributed this morning, it was for purposes of updating the information that was provided in the PAC. If you look at the PAC, all the information is provided. We just had to adjust information in relation to the PAC. It's not from us, it's from the department. Mr. Bane will then respond. Sorry about that.
We'll have to act harshly on the department. Really, we are going to punish the department. This cannot be accepted. But I think my question was around more especially the beneficiaries. It was not relating to the builders per se, because the builders really they have to comply. But I was referring to the beneficiaries, more especially the late enrollments. Yeah. So the other one, the last one, is about the status of what are your relations with the Eastern Cape government, because last year when they were here, they indicated that they were reluctant for NHDRC to do rectification program to their houses that they have in defense. So I would like to know what is the status now. Honorable State, and after this, let's try by only that we touch our questions and responses so that members can go for a short break. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, it's the last comment and question. Yes, I think I misunderstood your complaints and the conciliation, but it's because of a lack of information. What you in fact do not have in the document is how many claims have been lodged and how many you've dealt with. Because that would be important in terms of what you've paid out and the monies you've got. The important question that perhaps I should have asked right at the beginning, Chair, is relates to the alleged non-registration of subsidized houses by the department and various provinces over the last 10 years. And I want to come back again, like I did yesterday, to a specific example, Cardmore City, where it is once again alleged that all 8,000 units, subsidized units, have been rejected by NHBRC. Comment on that, please.
Okay. Thank you. I'm glad the issue of submitting documents late is not my challenge. Somebody else has to answer for that. Thank you, member. Late enrollment. The reason why late enrollment becomes a risk or poses a major risk to NHRC is the fact that if a house is not enrolled, it is likely not to be inspected. The Act provides for us to deal with late enrollment. Because when you enroll the house late, we haven't seen the foundation. We don't know what type of foundation you have erected. And we all know that the foundation structure is the most important aspect of the home. So we would like all the houses to be enrolled before any construction begins so that NHBRC can be afforded an opportunity to inspect and ensure that quality product is produced. The relationship with the Eastern Cape Provincial Department. NHBRC is involved in the Eastern Cape in terms of facilitating the remedial work or the rectification process. In the Eastern Cape, the first involvement of NHBRC came in at the point of evaluating the old houses that were built before 2002 when NHBRC became involved. And at the point when we had quantified the value and the extent of rectification, the provincial department requested us to assist them with technical capacity to facilitate the remedial process. The NHBRC then assisted them in terms of drafting the terms of reference for advertising and sourcing technical expertise to do the actual remedial work. We are involved in as far as project management of that whole process is involved. Okay. In future, we note this fact or the issue of omission in terms of quantifying the number of trains lost just as rectification. We will provide that information in future. Thanks.
Let's break for 5 minutes. Madam Chair, quickly on this. On the progress, depends on which progress you're talking about. If you've got a complaint and it's lower than progress, that's good. Because that means that we are getting less complaints, that's good. If the affiliation progress is lower than good, even though we've been down, I think that's what Mr. said, as my colleague said, we were low progress, that means we were doing better. Because we were putting the risks into place and less people were complaining. We expected and it got less. The biggest problem is on the enrollment side, we expect to register so many houses, which we deal with so far, and you don't get to those houses. That's a problem. Now, why? Because, as I said earlier on, the economic climate. And there's a delay because they're publishing projects, and then those bills will finish off, and they can't get funding for a new project. So there's a delay. Now, with this, now with the interest coming down, you'll find now they'll start projects again, and we'll start seeing that towards the end of the year and into next year. So the targets, you have to look at each way. Some are good being low and some are bad because they're the other way. So we actually shouldn't target to complaints because relatively we must handle every complaint. It doesn't matter if we targeted one complaint, we get 10 billion, we must handle all 10 billion. So I'm not going to say maybe, I think the problem is different. This is not a measurable ratio. Your enrollments are, your restrictions are, your risk is complaints, associations and that. You must do every single one. So don't target them. I mean, they need the figures. All right, so let's handle the targets. On the PHP, the housing, listen, we know that over the last few years, as and when SBA started taking over the actual enrollment of non-subsidy houses, it was a challenge. We had to start the concept. You know, each department works within their own budgets and that, and they work. And there's been a massive thing, especially to our CEO, in seeing all the departments and talking to all the individuals in order to get them on board. And you'll find out figures have been going up and going up and going up. The profits up a lot. And this whole concept of PHP, which we call owner builder, okay? The problem might be 200,000 units. We want to do 100. We want to do all of them. But we still have this argument of catching the people to make sure they're not hiding behind people's housing process. They must come on board. And we're working with them. At the moment, I can see what happens. Dr. Maharshi, our chap, goes out. We hear about a project. He goes to the province with his engineers. He sits there. He helps them complete the actual documentation. That's what we do now. We sign off the geotech there. We then make sure, because we've done the geotech, to find out that they're not going to hide this through a PHP. That's why we're looking at this massive increase in figures, because we committed to put people on the ground at every province now, as opposed to sitting in our office and saying, well, I hope somebody brings it in. So now we are taking engineers to the provinces and to the municipalities. Because my city story, I know we had a doctor in to Gateway. I've been there since a lot, we've beaten the thing to death. At that point in time, they didn't register. Okay, that's unfortunate. Now, NHB, the house is booked. Now, we've already got so many funds. We can go and dig up those foundations and see if they are, because most of the foundations is the problem, early on. We can dig it up. There's a cost involved. But that government says, but if it's non-governmental, we talk about non-subsidy. What we do with those people, yes, they pay the 500 grand, not fee matter, not penalty, sorry, fee, and that is to pay in respect of the guardian check. That's what it used to cover. Then we ask for a house, then we do an assessment of the house, and they have to give us a bank guarantee for 5 years. We don't cover that risk. So if you've got a project of $1 million, we do the assessment for the 500 grand, or that's the penalties I use incorrectly. We do the thing, it comes in, we say, oh, well, we've assessed this $1 million project, it's 800,000, risk of NHB, or to the conduit, we want a bank guarantee for 5 years to 800,000. So we don't let them off the hook. So the penalty is, or the fine is basically, you must give us 100% guarantee so that we cover ourselves. Because in normal times, we can't inspect the foundation. That's our biggest problem. That causes our claim. I hope I answered your question, thank you.
I think one more issue was the allegations in the media. They remain allegations. We have statistics. We have statistics of enrollment, both for projects as well as home enrollment by various provinces. In some provinces, you'll realize that there is predominantly PHP projects. As a result of which, we go as far as project enrollment. We don't do home enrollment. But we have statistics of performance. All provincial departments have been enrolling their projects.
Thank you very much, NHBRC. I think we're still going to have time to engage with NHBRC because the members have raised a lot of questions of an uncertainty in some questions. So there's still time for us to do the oversight. So we'll ask NHBRC again to come forward to the portfolio committee. Let's take a break for 5 minutes. We've already taken time of NHSC, but let's make sure that we're going to give them that 30 minutes that they were supposed to get in. Let's come back at 4:15.
Huh? Gracias. now, in our routine today,
Thank you.
Members, where are the members? The members are gone. Oh my God! Let's try, my daughter. Let's try. Guys, let's come back, please. Members, members, members. There was an honorable member on that side. Mama. Let's proceed with the members that are here.
Good morning, all. I first like to apologize for the absence of our CEO, Mr. Samson Marabi. He's not well today. So, delegated myself, David Eglis, who's the COO, and Zonia Adams, who's the CFO, to present to you. And thank you for the privilege of presenting. MHFC is an institution of the Department of Housing, or the Department of Human Settlements now, and our principal mandate is to broaden and deepen access to affordable housing finance for low to middle income households, and that's what our aim is to do. Our value proposition is that we support and participate in the BMG strategy by making housing finance accessible and affordable for low to middle income households, by facilitating the development of sustainable human settlements, and facilitating the development of a viable and sustainable low to middle income housing finance market. Our vision is to be the leader in the development financing of low to middle income housing, and our mission is to provide innovative and affordable housing finance solutions in the low to middle income market. Our objectives for the medium term were the effective delivery of housing finance to support government strategy of reducing the housing backlog, intensified delivery through strategic partnerships, and providing housing finance directly to the end user with the development and implementation of retail home loans offering. Just to look at 2009, we are just about completing our audit, and at the bottom line, the profit after tax is substantially higher than budget. Our lending income was virtually on budget, but we had some impairments. But just to put those into context, they're less than 2% of our book, and those that we have in fact written off, we usually try and work around them and work out solutions, but when that doesn't happen, we have to take that knock. Operating expenses were substantially below budget, particularly in areas like consultancy and marketing on our retail products. The next slide, we show the financial performance. Our profit before tax was 72% above budget. Operating income 11% below, due, as I said, to those impairments. Our operating expenses 21% below budget. And our investment and sundry income, because the interest rates remained high for longer than we expected, was 51% above. That obviously had an impact on our profit before tax. But overall, from the financial point of view, a successful year. On the wholesale side, NHSC has intermediaries through which it operates, and we also have a project financing side where we fund, and this is on the intermediary side. We found that our intermediaries, mostly in the incremental housing loan side, started the year very slowly, and we didn't make our budget on the number of loans issued. Our particular intermediaries are also finding that they are providing larger loans. They've moved up a little bit to the 10 to 12,000 because building materials have got that much more expensive, and the costs of borrowing are high as well. So just at this level of the market. So we were below budget on the loan side. We were above budget on units, which are mortgage bonds funded through our intermediaries. That was above budget and above value as well. So overall, on the intermediary side, we were below budget, but delivering houses, we're happy that units are being delivered. And although the incremental housing side is also important to the poorer person in the housing market. On the project side, there was also substantially above budget. The finance units were 11,000 against 7,600. And the disbursements, which are actual funds, were 435 million against a budget of 340 million. The projects that we fund include social housing, inner city landlords, B&G contractors, and integrated housing project developers. And although it was a difficult market, the results of 2009 were pleasing. And we are set up to cushion market failure, and I think that's what has happened during this year. And although the drop in the number of incremental loans caused our total impact number to be 25% below, the increase in the number of housing units financed resulted in disbursements being 20% above budget. So it was a different mix, so it does mean that you had more actual units being delivered through our disbursements. When we provide funding, we always try to involve the private sector, and on the incremental side, through supporting one of our clients, a major financial institution came in and gave them 500 million rand to do incremental housing, which obviously we didn't do, but that resulted in some 46,000 loans. So, but they needed our assistance to do that. On the project side, we dispersed 435, but there was an additional 705 million that went into those same projects from private sector and multilateral funders. So it means that we're not funding 100% of the projects, and that's what we aim to do. So that's always a positive. We have some very good projects in line. So this year we're having discussions on the similar sort of leveraging. In May 2007, we began a pilot retail project, which Mr. Chairman knows about, and we used the post office as a partner. For various reasons, that pilot did not meet expectations. There has been a report. I'm not going to go into the detail. But in October 2008, we released our own retail offering. We've done it quietly because we wanted to prove our systems. We were using call center mortgage originators and employers. And the intention of our retail offering was to fulfill the commitment of the expanded mandate and the President's statement in the State of the Nation address in February 2006, announcing the transformation of the NHSC into a bank. in the 2009 year, the systems and processes were developed and business commenced, and by year end, 2,238 loans had been approved, including 1,559 from a single employer. But a modest 3.29 million was deferred. These retail loans take a while with the deeds office and the registration. With NDA to National Treasury, the retail business NSST is being reviewed, and we will keep this committee informed as to where we're going on that. You know, obviously the market has changed rapidly, as you can see from NHBRC and from the banks, and I believe there was an announcement today that one of the banks is going back into 100% loans, but I haven't seen that announcement, but I do know that one of the multilateral companies has provided funding for them to give and given guarantees so that this will go back, so hopefully that will improve that market. There's a mandate revision in place. We've assumed that mandate has been approved. We were challenged to deepen and broaden our footprint, and in 2006 we looked at our business model and we offered a more comprehensive product range into our market. And we're waiting for final confirmation of that expanded mandate, but in the interim, the DFI review has been undertaken, and that could impact. We're meeting next week to follow up on that DFI review. The business plan incorporated, as it has done the last 2 years, the broadened mandate. We are looking to be reclassified from a 3A entity in terms of CFMA to a 3B. NHSC will require funding to meet the aspects of its business plan, and we have developed a funding model to access the additional funding. We've applied to be reclassified because as a 3A we don't have borrowing power. The transfer has now been recommended by the Minister of Housing, and National Treasury is dealing with it. They're sitting with the application to be changed. We have had some dealings with some funders who would be prepared to help us on the project side, but this case not from the retail side. Our developmental role as a DFI and one of the agents in the delivery of sustainable human settlements to low-income earners, NHSC needs to fund its activities at no cost or in a least expensive manner that will translate into lower cost of funding to the target client and align with market norms. Capital preservation and sustainability. We're well capitalized at the moment, and we've been sustainable since inception, which has allowed our capital base to grow from capital provider of 1 billion to 2.5 billion in 2008. The cost of funding for expansion in the NTS period will have a direct impact on the long-term sustainability of the corporation, and this would be enhanced through the strengthening of its capital base and minimizing exposure to external borrowing, which of necessity will be much higher than capitalization. The market conditions, while interest rates have reduced, one of the results of the credit and liquidity crisis is the aversion by lenders to the subprime housing market, making external debt an expensive solution, which is what we're finding when we were doing our funding model. And in particular, external debt capital market appetite for retail mortgage-backed paper is weak, given the impact of global subprime housing lending. And if you say low-income housing, they're immediately related to subprime. So as I said, the international funders are prepared to fund the other side of our business rather than the retail side. We just put our strategic plan into a slide to say that from 2010, where we expect to have 26,000 housing opportunities provided, both in wholesale and retail and incremental, we expect that to move to 29 in 2011 and 32 in 2012. Our disbursements will go from 909, which is substantially higher than last year, as I mentioned, it was 511. 2011 will go to over a billion, and in 2012, 1.3. And that is why we need the additional funding. And this last slide shows the funding that we need. Of that amount, the majority is for retail, 350 is for our wholesale, and the balance for retail. We have been in the 2010 budgets of the department, we do not have funding provided. So we have to make sure we have the funding for that 300 million. And this is available, but the rest of the NPF period we're not yet aware of. If you look at our current 2009 against our budget, just a breakdown. I've shown that in the slide before, but this is just a breakdown for members to see exactly how it's broken here. the breakdown of the 26, 29, and 32. Again, the disbursements, we have shown what the disbursements were. They are growing quite substantially over the 3-year period. Our target market is an affordable housing that covers households with total income of less than 15,000. That is, for the moment, would provide a home of about 350,000, which is, you know, they when you look at the stats for affordable housing, they mention 600, so we really are trying to be at the bottom end of that. We estimate that 60% of our funding goes to those earning less than 7,500. These would include many inner-city private rental units, social housing subsidy beneficiaries, BNG housing beneficiaries, integrated housing developments, and incremental housing borrowers. This would be a very difficult slide to reach, but what we tried to do here is we took the steps and said, what products are we offering to the various areas of our market? So right down to the lowest earners, there are some products within our product range that can target them. So and that's really what we're doing, from incremental loans to small mortgages and to providing social rental units through funding social housing institutions and inner city landlords. So we're trying to look at the spectrum and particularly to fund opportunities that are close to job opportunities in the inner city. So quite a bit has been done in the inner city. One of the companies, in fact, has been concentrated on Haoxing, is now moving to other areas such as the Eastern Cape and Durban to do inner city regeneration where they can find opportunities. And we will continue to fund them. And they, too, have attracted quite a lot of private sector funding. This map is just to show where in the provinces we have an imprint. We've been mainly wholesale funders, and we're funded organizations that operate all over the country, and as you can see, we are represented, our funding is available in all the provinces, some to a great extent and others as one would expect where the economic, if you look at Gauteng, a small province, but that's where the economic capacity is in the country, and you would expect more there, as in KwaZulu-Natal and the Western Cape. These are the our planned provincial involvement, which includes the amount of money leveraged from others. So we expect, with the amount of money, which is 909 million, that we expect to fund out of our own resources, we expect an additional 2 billion through the work of partners. That would include outside funders, the subsidies that are available. So the whole project, so the value of the project would be 2.9 billion compared to our funding, which is obviously a lot lower. So in fact, we would provide approximately 35% of that, 30% of that funding. We do say there's the opportunity in the market. We seek to work with other housing institutions and DFOs, which include NERSA and DBSA, so those people involved in housing. We've recently become involved in Housing Investment Partners, which is a salary-based product that's been brought to the market. And we were, in fact, partnering with PASH, Pan-African. It was going to be a 50-50 investment. Old Mutual has come into that loop, and they've taken 50% of those shares. And this is great for us because they also can come with the funding. So that product is currently being developed. We're applying for a personal code, and we're doing this, getting the systems in place so we could, there'll be two offerings on the retail side. On TUF, this is a company I mentioned which works in the Jersey inner city. We've provided 210 million out of a total funding of close to a billion that they've made in the inner city through being able to leverage the funding that we've given them. And they are moving forward, they're commercializing, and we will have an interest in that as well. Kuyata, we thought we'd mention that's local, it's a Western Cape. They really deal with the bottom end of the market in the Western Cape and in Port Elizabeth area, and they provide very small incremental loans to the very lowest of the market in the Western Eastern Cape. And we consider that as a long-term partnership that will improve access to housing finance in really some of the most disadvantaged homeowners. They're very small loans, though. They could be 1,600, 2,000. So it's a well-managed institution, and we're happy to be part of it. So they've recently applied for further funding, and we're certainly going to consider that. I'll pass over to Zonia on our budget income and expenditure statement and our balance sheet.
For the 2010 budget year, our main source of income is lending income. We are budgeting mainly because of the increased disbursement and also for the retail offering that give rise to the increase in lending income. But we are budgeting for a profit after tax of 78 million for the 2010 financial year, and that increases to 118 million in the 2011 and 175 in the 2012 financial year. A lot of the expenditure was related to the capacitation of the retail offering that is captured in the 2010 financial year. The growth on the balance sheet would also then come as a direct impact of the increased lending activities, which will see our balance sheet grow over the 3 years.
Just in conclusion, the plan for 2010-2012 takes into account the realities of the current economy, but also understanding that housing demand remains and that we have a responsibility to reduce the backlog. We're active in the housing finance arena and
if you take my time with me, they're not going to leave that house. This house completely, because these people have flown here, so we have to listen to them. But what is important must try to be shorter. Thank you.
I'll be short, Chairperson, because I need to leave as well. Yes, again, it's a lot of information to absorb, but it would appear that they are fulfilling their mandate. One observation that I'd like to make is in your budget sheet, it appears that you've made some adjustments to the figures from what we've got, your income statement, and what you just presented. Just an observation. Chairperson, very quickly, their mandate is to fund activities at no cost or in the least expensive manner. Now, will the transformation of NHSC into a bank, will it not have an effect on the cost to that particular target group? Thank you, Chair.
Over to you.
The intention is not to move into a complete bank. That, you know, since that 2006, there have been different ways of looking at it. And what we were meaning was that cost of funding. Currently, we are capitalized, and so there's no cost of funding. But the type of business we do is quite labor-intensive, has high overhead. And if we have to pay 7 or 8% interest, it means it has to come from the other side if we're going to be sustainable. So you won't be able to... We don't give no-income lending. But we try and keep it as close or below prime so that people can borrow lower. But if we have to borrow, obviously that has to change. So that's really what we're trying to say, that the indicative rates from funders where the minimum would be 6 or 7%. Currently, we actually have funds invested. So it would mean to an add-on cost to the end user.
Thank you. I think the transformation of NHSC as Parliament, we also need to take part in the on our work to ensure that we look very carefully what we think that can make this institution give affordable loans to the people. So it's also our homework that we need to do as Parliament. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, NHSC.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. To the begin. Thank you, Chair. I think this is the 10th time I've done this, and it's always an honor. It is the last time because I'm leaving Nature at the end of the month. No. Sure. So in fact, I mean, I sort of bolstered this presentation because I thought there'd be quite a lot of new members, so it's there for information and I don't really need to dwell on it. If I can just flip through one or two of the early slides, just to say that Nurture is the Development Finance Institution, a public entity and all those good things. It's unusual because it's also a joint venture between the Government of South Africa and the Soros Economic Development Fund. And that there's a mandate and a governance agreement signed between the Minister and the Soros Economic Development Fund in 2005, which contains our mandate. I'll skip through the various slides and just take us to the current mandate, which is just to say that NERSA's mandate is quite clear to ensure the availability of bridging finance to small, medium, and established contractors building low and moderate income housing and related community facilities and infrastructure. I want to dwell a little bit on that, those last ones, because as the department has been transformed from the Department of Housing to the Department of Human Settlements, so I'd like to say that for the last 3 years at least, Nurture has been doing as much as I'll show you, financing of the construction of clinics, creches, schools, health facilities of various sorts. So you see our mandate has been broadly that of financing contractors involved in human settlements and not just involved in housing. That's just to say that we finance smaller contractors, medium and larger contractors. 80% of the financing goes to, 80% of the contractors we finance are in fact smaller contractors and 80% are black, and it's not the same thing because there are large black contractors and small white contractors. So we shouldn't confuse smaller contractors with the empowerment status of those contractors. And they build subsidy housing, affordable housing, and community infrastructure. Chair, I just briefly want to note that we were about to hit since 1996 10 billion rand worth of projects supported to 1.6 billion rand worth of loans, and a total of loans to contractors in excess of 1,000 in that time, and that in that time 225,000 houses have been built on the project supported by Nurture. In the last financial year, just to say that those give you the values, so we're projecting loans to the value of about 412 million rand to projects, so all those projects. What I haven't put in the slide, and I apologize, is that those 72 housing projects, 16 subsidy housing and 12 in affordable housing, in the year contain about 30,000 houses. Obviously not all of them are built in the year in which they were approved. But that's what we did last year. And to give you an idea of the division by value by province, that's put up there. Now, the reason that Gauteng is such a large slice of that is that almost, in our opinion, 60 or 70% of all affordable housing that takes place in Gauteng. And so obviously the values are exaggerated because to the extent that we're supporting affordable housing programs as well as subsidy housing programs, Gauteng is there. But there's a fairly good spread among some of the poorest provinces. And we have got some projects in the Northern Cape, but they were too late for inclusion in the slide. So next year we will show 9 provinces in total. I'm intended to be presenting the kind of business plan. And as I said, the business plan is based on this environmental review, which says that we are in this financial crisis, that the banks have got more conservative, that they'll treat with deep suspicion promises of 100% loans because they'll be very limited in terms of the kinds of lending that there will be. The banks are beginning to withdraw from some of the bridging finance lending that they have taken from us in the past, and there is generally less construction activity, as has shown up in the report of the NHBRC, amongst other things. Chair, I just want to make the point that if you're a development finance institution, economic recessions and retreats from the bank are in fact moments of opportunity for DFIs, because that is when we should be stepping into the breach and financing activities that the banks are declining to finance. So I'm not saying economic recession is good, but I'm saying it is an opportunity for growth in development finance institutions. In the subsidy housing, we expect to see growth in outputs, and we expect to see larger contractors returning to the subsidy housing market because there's less going on elsewhere. So they'll have a greater interest now in financing subsidy housing, and I think we're beginning to see some of that. In the affordable housing market, there's undoubtedly a decline in sales. There's less housing being built. There are less loans being offered. We believe that that would indicate that there should be an opportunity for growth in rental projects, because rental projects don't require the same kind of credit assessment as the mortgage loans to people borrowing for affordable housing. And so in that market, we expect an increasing demand for nurture financing in that realm of helping to package rental projects. We won't finance long-term. We don't see that as our job, but we can finance the construction as long as someone else will come in and take that out. In our community facilities and infrastructure area, there's obviously going to be ongoing growth. It's funded by government. Government has committed, I think, to 787 billion rands worth of infrastructure development over the next 3 years. If you take only a tiny percent of that as going to smaller contractors who we finance, there's still more than enough space there for that program to double and redouble in size over the next 2 years. And we would hope to be able to meet that demand. Our organizational plan, there's some complex background to here, Chair, which I can't share with you. But effectively, having been based in Johannesburg only, without cost to nurture, because of the relationships with some of the institutions we work with, we expect to be able to open 5 regional offices, which will be in East London, Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, and the Free State. We would commit to projects in at least 8 provinces, and we want to focus greatly on our customers are our clients are contractors, and we have a major focus on improving the relationships throughout the country. And we want to improve further our project control and reporting capacity. That means we're going to spend some more money on communication and IT costs. If we've got 5 new offices, we have to brand them, and that costs more for the period, but there will be no other overhead involved in the running of those regional offices. I think I've brought my chief financial officer along for the sake of brevity. We decided that I would simply do the presentation. If there are questions on the balance sheet, we can answer. The one point I would like to make, Chair, is that we estimate our balance sheet as at the end of this last financial year at 500 million rand. I would like to make the point that government's contribution to that funding in the 16 years since Nurture, 14 years that Nurture has existed, has been 186 million rand. So the rest is money that we have raised from other sources, brought in by private investors, and we hope, therefore, that our request for further funding from government in the next financial year would be treated seriously, because we can show how we can gear that funding by bringing in other partners. In terms of the income statement, our profits are modest. They're better than last year. We made a 19 million rand loss because we had to write off a whole lot of bad projects in a particular province. We show after losses, additional provincial project losses, that we will make a 2.8 million rand profit this year. That actually means the company loses value, because it's not really enough to even compensate for the effects of inflation on our financial viability. And I think I will stop there. For anybody who's interested, those are our major expected sources of expenditure. I can explain any questions that there may be in relation to that, Chair, but I won't dwell on it any further. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Right, sir. Do we have any questions? Honourable members? Okay. Honourable Bonner? Bonner?
Just a quick one on your budget balance sheet.
other investments, which are not under the 2008.
That's fine. The 5.9 that is reflected there, it relates to our intention to buy shares on our intermediaries. I think we are currently applying through the department and the National Treasury in terms of PFMA to get that approval to buy shares.
Another thing?
Yes, I presume that we'll get more information on that from the annual report, but let me just say that from our side, we just want to thank Mr. De Beer. We've come to know him over the last 5 years and wish him well in his future endeavors, and I trust that there is a proper succession plan in place at the organization. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Singh. I think with NASA too, I think very soon the portfolio committee is going to take the oversight visits, and I think we will visit these institutions. We'll put them in our program. We'll prioritize these institutions. We need more time with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and greetings to the members of the committee. My name is Jablan Fagazi. I'm acting CEO of World Housing Loan Fund. I'm with my colleague, Nipot Fitek, who is our CFO. So we'll co-present, I'll start, and then I'll hand over to him. So I'll skip some of the slides, like the outline. And this is background information basically which talks to the establishment of drugs. And the key here, the drug is a partnership, is a result of a partnership agreement between the Germans and South Africa. And then Southern government established that in 1996 with the grant funding from the German government. This is the mandate, and our mandate basically is to provide affordable housing credit to low-income rural households, and also to focus on the implementation of the of rural development, especially the Integrated Sustainable Rural Development Program. So our vision, in terms of our mission, basically we want to maximize rural households' housing choices so that they can improve their housing conditions. But importantly, we do that as a wholesale finance company, lending through intermediaries who then on lend to individual borrowers in rural areas. In terms of what we do, I've included photographs basically because sometimes visual images can tell a better story than the words. I won't go through those. They basically portray what people have achieved accessing finance from our intermediaries, but also they portray what they still want to achieve, like installing ceiling on the street, extending the house further, connecting water to the house. We operate within the policy context because we are DFI. These are the three key areas within the PNG which RALF plays a significant part. In one is financial services market. We enable people to access finance, some of them for the first time, but also we play a role of crowding in private sector investment in that we also leverage finance from the private sector investors. In community housing is a core business of us. We enable people to access finance to extend their houses or effect other improvements to their houses. And also in rural housing, basically our loans contribute to the improvement of housing conditions in rural areas, including improvement of quality of traditional rural houses. policy context. Apart from the PNG, we also play a role in other government policy imperatives, like rural development, which is basically where we should be operating. SME development, in the sense that some of our intermediaries basically started as SMEs, they were startup, and then we believed in them, we measured them, and they've grown basically to bigger entities. And where they operate, some of them are contributing to job creation, and also we assist in addressing the needs of the second economy. Some of the people who are building these houses in rural areas are just local builders really who don't have, I'll say, formal employment. We also enable people to build or to add space where they are so they can use it for productive purposes like barber shops, crèches, and other income-generating activities. So we have involvement. We are an initial institution, but basically we land in all provinces through our intermediaries. So therefore, the provincial government, as well as other local government, our key partners, including traditional leaders. So in that regard, we have to engage with all spheres of government, as well as traditional leaders. And we are glad that we have started the process. We have engaged with the House of Traditional Leaders. We look forward to engaging them more as we implement our plan. So I'll hand over to my colleague, who will take you through the rest of the presentation.
Madam Chairperson, members of the board. Yeah, just a bit of background, like speakers have alluded to, current economic conditions are tough. We are in a recession and a lot of our clients are at the bottom end of the food chain. They get affected the most by inflation for fuel and food, and retrenchments also hit them the hardest. So we had to take all of these factors into consideration in preparing our budget, and as such, we you would see quite a bit of a downturn from previous years. I'm going to skip through a couple of slides here. I'll get to our challenges and opportunities page. The main challenge for Ralph is increased risk of bad debt. Like I alluded to, most of us end users are the people who are struggling the most, and unfortunately that is a fed through the system, through our intermediaries, and then ultimately to us. So that is a bit of a risk for us. At this stage, it's well managed, and we believe through credit control and NTA, things are improved and have improved dramatically from previous years, but nonetheless, it remains a bit of a risk. Our second risk is leakage, both in terms of non-rural and non-housing. As we've found in the last couple of months, most of the people are keen to get loans. There's still a huge demand for loans. Unfortunately, those loans are not being used for housing. People are using the loans basically just to sustain their basic living conditions, paying for food, paying for schools. And although it's a necessity, unfortunately for us, it's also a problem in terms of meeting our mandate. Our third biggest challenge there is high interest rates to the end users. Basically, we as Ralph have been funded by basically a soft loan and a bit of grant funding. On this loan, we have to pay basically 8% interest, and as such, we it's very difficult for us to pass on lower interest rates to the end user. Having said that, we are very excited about the grant capital that has been approved for us for the 2011-2012 years from government, so that's 50 million rand a year. In preparation for that, we as an organization have targeted two sort of broad-based community organizations that we want to create this year. We want to target some low-interest products, which we actually believe will be quite successful. Opportunities for us, like I said, we're going to get some money from government. And, of course, the individual rural housing subsidy voucher scheme, quite a mouthful, is also a very exciting product and project for us, and we hope to get a trial period or trial running on that in the second half of this year. If we're looking at sort of the history over the last couple of years, this is our cumulative disbursements. You would see 2008, we got very close to 600 million. We broke that and got very close to 7 for our 2009 year. The lack of funding is actually putting a bit of a constraint on us for 2010, and although we still expect to grow, the growth rate is actually decreasing a bit. number of loans approved. You would see again there we are seeing a bit of a downturn in the 2010 year. Again, basically because of funding. We're not getting any funding from government in the 2010 year. It's solely only generated funds that we have seen this year. That's just the annual disbursement growth over the years. A number of intermediaries, like I alluded to, we wanted to get some community-based channels. We've just sort of identified that as key for us to get low-interest products into the market. We're very proud of this graph. That's our cost of revenue curve. And then you would see that over the last 3-4 years has been very stable at below 50%. Which we're very proud of. This is impairments versus advances, and you would notice there that our impairments rate is static at about 16%, and we'd like to keep it at that sort of level. This is also a slide just going back a bit further to 2003, where we actually incurred quite a huge financial losses due to some write-offs that were taken on bad loans, but as you can see, that's all been wiped out just about, and we are looking forward to the future. Disbursements in terms of the various provinces that we are in, we target to have at least 70% of our loans outside of Gauteng. We didn't quite get there this last financial year, missed it by 1%, but we're very keen that we'll meet it in the next financial year. Borrowers' income levels, again, we probably 60% of our money goes to below 3,500 rand per month income. Loan usage, like I said, there is always a leakage factor, but we're very happy that we reported about almost 80% of the money does go to housing. This is our balance sheet forecast for the year. You'll see that there's some limited growth for the next financial year, but in 2011-2012 we expect to see quite a bit of growth with that capital injection from the department. And our liability side, income statement, we see moderate growth in revenue, but costs remaining basically static. And the rest, basically, I'm just going to skip through that. It's our corporate governance. We rate ourselves very highly on our corporate. We've got a very strong non-executive board, audit committee, and that's it from my part.
Thank you very much to the presenters. Questions? Honorable Foreman, Honorable Singh.
Just a simple question, really. The leakage, and I think you're referring there to where people are taking a loan and using it to live, to eat, I suppose. And when one sees the poverty out there, one can understand that. What monitoring, and I hear you saying that, you know, there's a very small percentage, we're talking about 20% here. What controls do you have on monitoring, you know, the loans that you do give for that specific purpose? And then I'm just quite interested, you know, in why you have not received anything from the department for 2019. Is that because your performance has not been so good, or it's been so good that you don't need the money, or what? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My question really follows up on the earlier one, the one just asked. Where the 80% that do use the funds for either extending an existing house or building one, and I think the pictures are obviously said very informative. But I would imagine your organization doesn't have any control or monitoring function. And it is a bit of a concern because, you know, that becomes the investment of their family. And I'm looking at one of your photographs here with a family standing in front of a half-completed house. And if you look at the brickwork at the top there, which is going to support the roof structure, I mean, there's very little bonding between those bricks compared to the lower brickwork. Now, you know, that the first major storm in this rural village, and that roof is going to go. So there goes the investment as well. So that's really my question.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Stating that the organization is a national wholesale housing finance institute. When you look at the disbursement and geographic spread, it's contrary to what the organization actually supposed to be. Chairperson, I can invite the organization to the Northern Cape, to Limpopo, to Eastern Cape, where there is poor people to the utmost. And it's quite clear from my observation that there's a home nest in the Gauteng province. We need to expand our distribution in terms of these assistance to other provinces, especially the Eastern Cape, the Northern Cape, Northern Cape, Mier, Rooiwal. There's a lot of places in the Northern Cape where I believe that people would love and would need this assistance, not to speak about Limpopo as well. So this is really, I think the question would actually arise, is this really some sort of a national wholesale organization when you look to the statistics?
Thank you. Well, on the question of leakage, it's very, very, very difficult for us to monitor on the ground on what actually happens with each loan. So this is unsecured lending. But what we try to do is that at the time people take a loan from a lender, they actually indicate the purpose for which they will use the loan. And then on monthly basis, each lender returns to us a report, which we call housing impact monitoring. But basically, that's come from the form that is filled in by the borrower. Then what we do at certain intervals, like currently, we conduct an independent impact assessment survey, which in the past has basically, I would say, corroborated, you know, the housing impact monitoring. But we cannot rule out that in some instances there is an element of lying when people are filling in the forms. But basically, what we are trying to encourage is that our intermediaries, you know, look at the possibility of using building material suppliers as a channel for distributing the loans, because we think that can contribute to the lowering of the leakage. So some of our intermediaries are becoming following that road, you know, but people can still walk in and apply for a loan and get it. It's unsecured loan. I think with regard to why we didn't get funding from the department this year, basically, I don't think it's a reflection of poor performance from our part. I think it's just realities. I know that the CEO is here. The intention was that we'll get funding this year. But I think when the final allocations were made, I think there are many other priorities within the government sector. The idea that we'll get funding from next financial year. But certainly it's not poor. It's not a reflection of poor performance of RAV. Well, I understand the issue that is raised by Mr. Stain. I think really it's very difficult because rural enable people to try their own building process. You know, in that regard, we wish they'd avoid common building, you know, mistakes that happen out there when people really are hiring local builders to build houses for them. What we encourage our lenders to do is to distribute what we call building advice handbook so that people can at least understand the basic building process so that they will know that over, say, the window, there has to be a lintel so that you don't see a crack. That's the best that we can do, because otherwise, if say we have to get inspectors to be in each and every site where there is incremental housing process going on, that will not be feasible. We wish we can, but the reality is that we can't. Geographic spread, I understand the honourable members' you know, concern. As you would see, that the housing basically, that's where the largest proportion of our loans go. I think it's a result of many, you know, I would say issues, you know, apart from the fact that most of our lenders are headquartered in housing. But I think another reflection in those figures, some people who basically reside in, who work in housing, they take loans, but then they don't invest in housing. They invest in the same Cape where they come from. If you look at the mine workers in particular, even the allowance that they get from the mining companies, they prefer still to stay in informal settlements and change their allowances and invest it where they come from. That gets reflected as well, you know, in the figures, I mean, or rather in the loan itself, I mean, distributed. But, well, we will certainly try the best that we can to lend in all provinces. But sometimes as a wholesaler, having great way of private, you know, intermediary, I mean, there's always, you know, find various mechanisms. Some mechanisms, I mean, distribution channels, rather, will enable them to lend more in the dinner than others. So I think our first try for us is if we're in each and every province, we get, say, a lender who will just focus in that province. But our lenders, basically, they lend in more than one province. Sometimes this will reflect also a demand, you know, for housing microfinance, you know, from our lenders. But certainly, we are a national institution. You know, we always strive to lend in all provinces, especially in rural areas. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I thought it will assist the committee just to appreciate a little bit of this context. The one being that for many years, the department has not been capitalized in RALF. It is only when we entered the discourse that we want RALF to expand its reach and reduce the cost to the end user that we decided to capitalize it. The timing of that is a function of the fiscus, really. But clearly the department is set in respect of capitalizing RALF for those objectives. The other relates to the what I call the reach and perhaps the geographic spread, in that one of the risks that faces all of our DFIs is that once the end user knows that this money is from government, the risk of defaulting increases phenomenally. Hence their limitation to be out in the public and say, we are RALF, we are giving you a loan, and quickly an end user will begin to add one and one and realize this is from government. They will then take advantage of that. But second to that is a similar risk that our rental program is dealing with, in that once people know they are renting from government, they choose not to pay and they dare government politically to come and take them out. So those are some of the nuances that the committee would appreciate, but hence the prevalence of the use of intermediaries to cushion and mitigate that risk. Having said that, for NHFC, NURTURE and RALF, there is currently a review of all the housing development finance institutions, the three. That is in the context of overall the review of development finance institutions in government, the outcomes of which are subject of the executive consideration, but hence each one of them reflect or referring to a potential impact of a change in mandate or otherwise, but those conclusions are not yet made. In time, I'm sure the committee will be appraised once the executive has come to conclusions around the appropriate direction for these three development finance institutions. But I'm sure the committee will be appraised in that regard. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, sir. I think we will request the minister even before the cabinet approves, just to inform us what is the process. Situation. We hope that the Deputy Minister is going to assist on that one. We don't say we are going to take their responsibility, but at least it would be very much important for the committee before they are being approved, just to know, the Minister to give us on the status of what is going on, whatever. I think we have come to the end of our program for the day, and I wish to thank the presenters and also the honorable members
for them to stay until the end, because it is very much important that we complete these public hearings while before they get here. So we have to try by all means to bear with the office of the chairperson, because it's not because of the parliament program. There's too much pressure on the parliament program. Deputy Minister, with your entourage, we change very much. But I think we can give you the closing remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for that opportunity. Thank the committee for inviting the department. I just want to say, with regard to NHSC, for example, we have noted that you didn't give us the breakdown in terms of the funding that you are doing in terms of different projects nationally. That's very important to know where the allocations of those funds are going to. We hope that in your engagement with you, you'll be able to give us that. I'm happy with that. Look, though you are going down in terms of the interest, and I hope that 7 to 10% interest will go across the board. Maybe that is the approach that you are taking. But I think I would assist the committee in terms of ensuring that if we wait for this restructuring in terms of the different housing institutions, we'll keep abreast in terms of development. And we thank you for engaging with us right now. But thanks, Ralph. Thanks for all the institutions that did the presentation. The work is ongoing. We are excited about HDA. But what you are saying, it should not be a talk shop. We want to see housing units on the ground. It's about fast-tracking housing delivery. This is what we want to see on the ground. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you very much. You have a good journey, travel safe, and have a good weekend, everybody. Let's see.